Although she might not be a household name today, the Norwegian soprano Kirsten Flagstad, who died 50 years ago this month, became a huge star after making her debut at the Metropolitan Opera in New York in 1935, where she went on to sing all of Wagner's greatest female roles. Today I'm talking to Dr. Tim Lockley from the School of Comparative American Studies at the University of Warwick about his interest in Flagstad and why the onset of World War II derailed her career. So thanks very much, Tim, for joining me. So Kirsten Flagstad might not be a very familiar name to people now, but she was as famous as Maria Callas or Pavarotti in her time. How did you first come across her work?
Well, it was when I was probably a teenager, and I was interested in listening to Wagnerian operas. And back then, the big edition of The Ring was the Scholte Ring, issued in the 50s and 60s, and it had great, you know, famous names of the time, but a lot of the critics talked about the previous generation and talked about Flagstad as one of those figures that are worth listening to. And back then, which would be like in the 80s, there weren't that many of her recordings still available. But there's a famous recording of Tristan, which she did in 1952, which you can listen to. And actually, she does feature briefly in the Decca Ring in 1958. She sang a very small part in Das Rheingold. But then I was encouraged to sort of explore her repertoire, recorded repertoire, going backwards in time, right back to the 1930s. And then you hear this sort of massive, massive voice, which is what you really need to sing Wagner well. You need a big, solid voice that can sing over a Wagnerian orchestra, which is bigger than most orchestras. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to sing so that everyone can hear you in the auditorium. You also need that sort of longevity of career and stamina, which often doesn't occur sort of in harmony with the Wagnerian singer. You get somebody who sounds fantastic in Wagner, and after 2 or 3 years, their voice is gone because it's just so demanding to sing it. Mm-hmm. She wasn't like that. She was a person who could come in and she could sing Wagner almost day in, day out. Mm. And she could sing, and she sang it for quite a long period of time. Mm. But she quite deliberately never sang Wagner until she was about 40. So when she came to the Met in New York in 1935 and she started singing the big Wagnerian roles of Isolde and Brunhilde, she was already had a long career behind her singing lighter roles in Norway. And then she started singing the Wagnerian operas in New York, and it was just an immediate overnight sensation because they'd never really heard of her before. Mm. She'd had a very muted career in Europe, and then she explodes onto the international scene in New York in 1935. And then for the next 6 years, she is the Wagnerian soprano in New York. She sings all the major roles, and she had the good fortune to be partnered by probably the leading Wagnerian tenor ever, a guy called Lauritz Melchior, who's a Danish tenor, and nobody has sung Wagner like him. And putting the two of them together was such massive box office for the Met that they couldn't resist pairing them as often as they possibly could. And a lot of people who've studied the Met's history say that without Flagstad and Melchior in partnership, that the Met could easily have folded in the 1930s, because we're talking about the Depression, when ticket sales are falling. Once Flagstad and Melchior pair up and they start performing regularly at the Met, then every performance they give is sold out. She also had the good fortune that her very debut in New York was broadcast on the radio as Sieglinde in Die Walküre, and she followed it up a couple of weeks later with Tristan and Isolde. So she reached a nationwide audience in the US of like 10 million. And then suddenly she's got that national exposure, which means she's massively in demand for concerts and tours, and everybody sort of has heard of her, and she becomes very much a household name. When you talked about her being the Callas and the Pavarotti of her day, absolutely. She was probably the most famous singer in the world in the late 1930s. And she sang in New York, she sang in London, she sang in San Francisco. They did like an annual tour of the great opera houses of the world. That's why she becomes so sort of famous, because everybody is trying to get hold of her to sing.
Mm. And that's incredible. As you said, the stamina required to sing Wagner is huge.
they're very big, long roles. I mean, Tristan and Isolde is 4 hours long. The first act is like an hour and 20 minutes. And she sings most of it. Isolde sings most of the first act. Mm. She sings a large part of the second act, and she gets a bit of a rest in act three. Roles like Brunhilde, in the longest part of Brunhilde is Götterdämmerung. She sings in every single act for large chunks of it. And so it's almost like singing a Puccini opera or a Verdi opera twice in the same evening, because that's the length of them. They're 4 hours long, and the stamina required, you have to be as good in the last act as you were in the first act. There's no point expending all your energy, and so you've got nothing left to give in the last act. Absolutely, but she could, and so could Melchior, and the two of them together were as good in the last act as they had been in the first act.
Mm. Incredible.
And that's often the big showpieces, like in Tristan and Isolde, the big Liebestod, which is the final climax of the opera, is the very last thing she sings after, after 4 hours.
Incredible.
In the last sort of 7 minutes.
And such a beautiful...
She had such a solid technique and such a solid tone, and it sounds so sort of powerful and untroubled by the demands of the music.
Yeah.
And most singers don't sound like that. Most singers can't give that kind of flood of tone, which she could always give. And she had such an even voice throughout her production. I mean, from the lowest notes to the highest notes, she had them all, and there weren't obvious breaks in the voice, which sometimes you get. And she didn't have a big wobble, which, again, voices can develop. She had that sort of solidity of tone. It was just a very reassuring sound to listen to.
And I'm just doing a bit of research on Flagstad. I found an interesting quote. She once said, "It may disappoint some people who would have preferred to find a glamorous and mysterious female figure in a singer like me, but I can't do anything about that. Away from the stage, I'm just a perfectly normal woman." What was her personality like? What were her performances like?
She's often a very described, both herself and other people described, as a very down-to-earth person. She wasn't into the sort of diva personality. She didn't, for example, spend a lot of time, big parties where she would be dressing up like red carpet type events.
Yeah.
That wasn't really her style. She was very much like interested in domestic life, and in she was focused obviously on her family life. She wasn't flashy like that. She liked home cooking, all those kind of things. She famously was a knitter, and would, for example, during recordings, knit when she wasn't singing, as a sort of, that's how she sort of occupied her time. When she recorded Dash Rheingold, right at the end of her life in 1958, when she recorded this small section of Dash Rheingold, a lot of the other singers, of course, had come up much younger than her, you know, and they were in the big name parts. Had didn't really know anything about Flagstad. They knew of her reputation, of course, but never really heard her sing. And then they saw this mature, matronly woman knitting in the corner and wondered, what, you know, gosh, she must be past it. And then she stood up and delivered her viol, and it was like they were all blown away by this gorgeous voice that came out, and she was already like 63 at the time.
Yeah,
so.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about Flagstad's, well, during the war, really, because her name was kind of drawn into disrepute by her second husband. Can you tell us a bit more about what happened?
Yeah, she married this guy who was a prominent businessman in Norway back in the 30s, and he was in Norway when the Germans invaded and occupied Norway in 1940. She was in New York, singing in New York. There was some question about whether she was going to go back to Norway at that point in 1940, and she decided to remain in the States for another year. But by the April of 1941, she decided she was going to go back to Norway, even though it was under occupation. And this was a controversial decision at the time, to go back and live under German occupation. But she did it. And she left New York in April of 1941, arrived back in Norway, spent the war basically in Norway. I think she did sing a little bit in Switzerland, but she certainly never performed in Norway. She never performed in occupied Europe, ever. She's unlike quite a lot of her contemporaries, who, you know, there were certainly Swedish singers, for example, who sang both in occupied Europe and in allied countries as well. She refused to sing in Norway, but her husband was quite closely allied with the Quisling Party politically. Flagstad, there is evidence that Flagstad tried to persuade him to leave this political party, and she herself wasn't political at all. At the end of the war, her husband was arrested, he was put in prison, and he dies in prison in 1946. He never actually gets to trial, doesn't live that long, but he dies in prison in 1946. And Flagstad is tainted by association with him. Even though there's absolutely no evidence that she was a collaborator, I certainly say she certainly never performed in Nazi-occupied Europe. And there's a controversy about whether she's going to be allowed to sing again, you know, where she's going to be allowed to sing. And it's about another year until early 1947 before she actually gets a passport to leave Norway. So the Norwegian government are partly responsible for that kind of tension. But eventually they do give her a passport to leave Norway in 1947, and she performs immediately in France and in Britain. And so the qualms that you might think existed in those two allied countries disappear very quickly, and she performs fairly regularly in both France and Britain. The problem is in the US. There's a lot of controversy about her performing in the US, and she performs fairly quickly in the US in late 1947, doing concerts and things like that, but she doesn't get opera engagements, and the Met management refused to have her back. Some of the concerts that she's planned to give are cancelled because of protests by veterans groups, for instance, and other concerts, they have pickets outside protesting about her performing, and this occurs over a number of years. It's not just like a one-off event in 1947, you see it again in 48, 49, 1950. During that time, she is performing in some smaller opera houses by like 1948, 49. She's appearing in New Orleans, and she's appearing in Chicago and in San Francisco, but not at New York, which is the biggest, you know, opera house in the US. She does appear in Latin America. She's appearing in Buenos Aires, in Cuba, Venezuela, those sorts of places as well as in Europe all this time. And it's not until the Met management changes in 1950 that policy changes. And the new manager is Rudolf Bing, and Rudolf Bing changes a lot of things at the Met. And he gets rid of a lot of the old singers who have been there a long time, and he brings back or brings in new ones. And one of the ones he brings back, and he's determined to bring back, is Flagstad. And there's negotiations that go on for a period of time about her coming back. And she comes back in right at the start of 1951, so it's almost 10 years, from 1941 to 1951, when she's not at the Met. She comes back in 1951. She sings for two more seasons. In 1951, she sings her traditional Wagnerian repertoire, Isolde, Brunhilde, those kind of things. And her last Wagnerian performance there is as Sieglinde. And then she comes back the following year, and she sings what is a new opera for her. She sings Gluck's Alceste in 1952. And those are her last 2 years at the Met. And so it's a sort of a truncated reemergence on the operatic stage in New York, but she has been singing in Covent Garden and La Scala and places like that throughout this period. And in 1953, that's when she finally leaves the stage, and her last performances are as Dido in Dido and Aeneas in London.
And that's so strange that in America, you know, it was such a different reaction to her. Why do you think, was that due to the media coverage?
I think it partly is, and I think it's a good story that Flagstad is, you know, or has been party to collaboration. It's a lot of misinformation. The role of the mass media, of course, is very important in the US. The sort of agitation that goes with that, and people are stirred up about things without necessarily having full facts, full information, or asking her.
Yeah.
And there are always people who will defend Flagstad, even in the US, and say, whatever the rumours, it's not true.
Yeah.
But, so there are some instances of her being heckled and, you know, of concerts being cancelled. I think she found it quite distressing because I don't think she felt that she was political in any way and she hadn't deserved this kind of vilification.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But she makes her career elsewhere, and I think it's partly America's loss that she doesn't sing in the States quite so much as she might have done. But she certainly performs plenty in Covent Garden in London and La Scala and places like that as well, so...
Great. Now, I just wanted to round off really by asking you about some particular research you've been doing on a series of radio broadcasts from the Metropolitan Opera during the 1940 and 1941 season. Can you just tell us a bit about those broadcasts and what kind of insights you've gained?
Yes, these were a series of intermission features that were broadcast during the 1940-41 radio season. There's about 15 operas broadcast in that year. And they commissioned a series of radio talks which they called Our American Way of Living. And they were organised by the National Council of Women. And they invited leading figures of the day, including university presidents, industrialists, poets, playwrights, a former minister to Norway, the former president Herbert Hoover. One of the most striking names is Walt Disney. He actually gives a talk on culture. And each of these figures were invited to give a 10-minute talk on some aspect of our American way of living, which could be our American democracy, our American inventiveness, our American women, our American culture, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about them is that the way they're basically trying to defend American culture from perceived Nazi propaganda, because Nazi propaganda is making its way into the Americas, especially North America, via shortwave.
Mm.
And there are German residents and American residents who can pick up German broadcasts on the radio. And they're trying to counter that kind of propaganda by reinforcing what it means to be an American. So they stress things like democracy and participation, and it's against totalitarianism, all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really interesting is the timing, because here we are 6 months before Pearl Harbor. So America is not in the war, but it is certainly assisting the Allies, certainly assisting Britain with its war effort through things like the Lend-Lease program and providing munitions and arms and all those kind of things to Britain. So everyone knows which side America is sort of on, but not officially. Here you've got a radio audience of 10 plus million, a lot of whom are wealthy, established people. I mean, they do demographic studies of their audience and they can tell that they're of, you know, upper class, relatively upper class people, because that's the people who they've got good incomes, they've got, you know, cars, all those kind of things. This is the population they're trying to reach. And it's only for domestic consumption. These broadcasts are not sent overseas, because there is a Latin American feed for the Met Opera broadcast, but they don't carry the intermission features, just the opera. So you've got these broadcasts which are telling you how to be an American and what it means to be an American, reinforcing that message of about American distinctiveness, countering Nazi propaganda, which is all the time saying, you know, democracies are weak, democracies are the dinosaur system. They're on their way out. They can't beat our organised, efficient, scientific systems. And that's the message they're trying to counter.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it in a really interesting way by getting these really important figures to sort of talk about these select issues of the day.
And I just have just one extra question. Was America at the time, there seemed to be a great interest in European culture at that time. Does that come through?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's partly because there's a long history of that, going right back into the 18th and 19th centuries, where American culture is more slightly imitative of European culture, yeah. and they import mm-hmm. a lot of the key aspects of European culture. But also remember, America's population is very European at the time. There are large numbers of ethnically British people, but also large numbers of ethnic Germans, ethnic Italians. These are people who were bringing that aspect of their culture as well. Mm-hmm. And there aren't that many homegrown American musicians, composers, conductors. There are a few, and they are increasingly significant, people like Aaron Copland and Samuel Barber, but they're nowhere near as major as people like Wagner or Beethoven and Mozart. These are the established European classical figures who have been imported into America. There is that sort of respect for culture, and even to the extent that they continue to perform, for example, Wagnerian operas throughout the war, even though Wagnerian operas are tainted by Hitler's love of Wagner.
Yes.
And there's musicians who say it doesn't matter. Wagner's music is for everybody, and this music is for it doesn't. Hitler can't own this music. We shouldn't let him own it. Mm. And that's really quite enlightened.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it? Because they could easily have said, "Oh well, if Hitler likes Wagner, then the rest of us won't touch it." But they did really struggle to keep hold of those kind of Germanic musical traditions, which are so important, and provide them to a wider audience. And Tristan and Isolde, for instance, even though it's 4 hours, was consistently the highest rated opera, the most popular opera that the Met could broadcast. And some years it broadcast it twice. So you could get, one every 3 months, you could get another broadcast of Tristan and Isolde. Mm-hmm. And that's even though it was sort of tainted by its association with Nazism.
Well, that's really interesting. Thank you so much, Tim, for talking
to
me today. And do visit the Knowledge Centre again soon for more insights and expertise from Warwick's research community. Thank you.